Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. We have got an absolutely fascinating topic today. Well, I found it fascinating, and I hope you will too. History is something that I really enjoy. And individuals who have had a major effect on history, but who rarely are even heard about, intrigue me even more. And I received this book called Sexual Outlaw, Erotic Mystic. And when I saw the title, I thought, but the cover shows the face of a woman who is lovely, absolutely lovely. Her time frame was the 1800s. Her name was Ida Craddock. I guarantee you, you have not heard about this woman, but she is a woman that lived a life and has a story to tell that is absolutely unreal. And Vera Chappelle is my guest. And he is the man that has brought her story to light. Vera, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm just amazed that a man like yourself took the time to do the research on this. Give us a little bit of your background. What is it that you do? And then also let us know how it is that this woman grabbed your attention.
Well, I am a sexologist by training and by profession. I study human sexuality, and I'm interested particularly in the history of human sexuality and of sexual expression, how cultures and societies have dealt with sexuality over the years. And Ida Craddock plays an important role in that history, although she was not very well known until quite recently. And also, I'm a member of a secret society, you might call it. It's really an organization, an educational and fraternal organization that deals with spirituality and sexuality called Ordo Templi Orientis. And one of the early leaders of that group, Aleister Crowley, wrote about Ida Craddock in the 1900s, early 1900s. And so that was how I first found out about her, was by perusing his writings and seeing that he had written a complimentary review about her work. And so that's what intrigued me. That's what got me interested in her story.
I found that the history that you presented in the foreword of your book, you should have seen my yellow highlighter. It was having a field day. I was amazed, absolutely amazed, to find out that in the United States, sexual surgery was done on women. Now, we know in many countries throughout the world, there has been a lot of public outcry against doing this. And we think it's abhorrently, you know, it's just a hideous thing to do to a woman. But it was done here in the United States, and I had no idea it was done. And as you said in the book here, to curb rebelliousness, sexual excess, and masturbation, it reached its height in the United States during Craddock's lifetime, which was the 1800s. And it was routinely performed. I mean, this is just something that just infuriated me when I read it. Of course, it's not the 1800s. It was routinely performed to cure female insanity and rehabilitate prisoners. And female castration was thought to make a woman more trackable. I mean, orderly, predictable, and cleanly. This just blew me away. And among middle-class women, whose ideal was a passionless sexual restraint, physical response was perceived as coarse, common, and immodest. Holy Moses! I mean, this was just amazing. Now, this was something, again, with all the various things that I've read, I had no clue that it was going on in the United States in the 1800s.
Yes, absolutely. Much of what, when we think about human sexuality and our approach to it, so much of it is colored by our culture, by the context in which we deal with it. And a lot of things that we look at today as being abhorrent, as being awful, which they really are, were nonetheless accepted and, as you mentioned, widely practiced in the U.S. and other places during different eras, and in some places still in the world, unfortunately, today. So a lot of that is colored by the times. You have to look at, when you look at someone like Ida Craddock, you have to look at the context of the times in which she was writing. So many of the things that she writes about are perhaps difficult for us to understand today, given mm-hmm. that if we look at it with the filter that we look at today. Like, for example, we say that she was progressive, but she was very much against masturbation. She thought that it was not only immoral, but also unhealthy, that it would lead to neurological problems and other health problems. But this is what everyone believed at the day. That was mm-hmm. the science of the 1890s that had concluded that. So that's the context we have to look at. We can say, well, when she says that doesn't seem very progressive. But many of the other things that she was writing about were very progressive for her time.
Absolutely true. I was just astonished. And you're correct. When you read it, and that is something that is very, very difficult for people to get straight in their heads. They want to change what people understand about the past. And one of the things that I appreciated about your book was your candor in presenting the information as accurately as possible relative to the time frame she lived in. Because if we try to say, well, this shouldn't have even been, you know, we shouldn't even discuss this, this is something that's not appropriate, I disagree. I think that this is a point of information that really gives insight into the psyche of the patterning that evolved, and women need to know that this was done and that it was because of an active awareness, education, and understanding that we were able to get past some of this barbarism. I mean, it's just horrid stuff. But you have to change your thinking before you'll change anything else. And she was a stimulus to this. I just have a great deal of appreciation for the woman and her courage, because in her era, women literally had no rights. They just didn't have it. So her story is incredible. Now, let's talk about her writings a little bit, because she did publish things. And she had a mother who was absolutely hideous in the way that she treated her. Of course, in her mother's mind, she had this decadent daughter that was just absolutely, just totally horrid. And she tried to control her whole life, even as an adult. And because of the way life was at that time, the mother was able to exert a great deal of that. But she still did her writing. And there was a reason that this writing was saved, and it was due to an attorney. Tell us about how he found it important enough where he said, I'm going to protect what this woman has written.
Right. The attorney was a man named Theodore Schroeder, and he was a member of the American Secular Union right around the turn of the century. That was a group that was concerned with free speech and particular combating religious censorship. And but he came just after Ida Craddock's time. He had never met her, but he became interested in her case after her death, and so he was the one who collected all her papers together. And the bulk of it, interestingly, came from the estate of a man named W.T. Stead, who was in England, or Stead. He had died on the Titanic along Ooh. With his wife, but his daughter, Estelle, had kept all of the papers, and Ida Craddock's papers had been sent by her right before she died, had been sent by her to this man in England, and it was Schroeder who managed to convince Estelle, his daughter, to send the papers back to the U.S., and that's where they are today in a university library.
I think, again, history has so much to share with us, and there are so many different perspectives that you can see dependent on your lens and what you're able to have access to. So I think you've really done us a service. Now, you make a statement, I'm going to quote it directly from your book, that she was as rigorously honest and articulate recorder of a whole class of human experience that modern science has yet to examine with any kind of true open-mindedness. Why is that the case? Why is it that scholars wouldn't want to touch what she had written? What are they afraid of?
Well, female sexuality. When you look today, even today, when you look at things like how much research has been done on male sexuality in terms of Viagra and everything dealing with erectile dysfunction and all these things, and yet there's very little comparatively that's been dedicated to female sexuality, I think there is some kind of bias, a systemic bias in the science and in society's measure of the importance of female sexuality. And so that's the reason that even today, I think it tends to be discounted and not looked at with as much interest and rigor. In her time, what she was doing was she was actually fulfilling the role of what today sex counselors, sex therapists, and really psychotherapists do a great deal of time on, marriage and family counselors and those people. That profession didn't exist when she was doing this in the 1890s. Mm-hmm. Mostly you would go to your doctor or you would go to your priest or your pastor. Both of those professions would have their obvious drawbacks when you're talking about sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so she began counseling her patients. She called it educating them. Really, she mm-hmm. was giving sex education long before its time. She mm-hmm. She had an office, and she would see her clients and teach them about basically how to satisfy one's wife in one's marriage. Female sexual satisfaction was the focus, and that's something, as I mentioned, hasn't even since been getting as much attention.
You make a statement about her passion was really to have women become liberated in the sense of understanding their own sexuality, but also because of the social status of the female, and generally women were taught you marry so that you don't marry for love or affection. You'd be practical about this because you can't go out and make a living. You can't do things for yourself, so you've got to find someone that's going to be able to support you. Now, she was not of that mindset. She wanted to be totally self-sufficient. So she really was quite an interesting woman. I found her story just fascinating. But because her subject was sex, and again, I'm quoting from your book, only within marriage, of course, she was not encouraging, you know, intimacy among single people. But again, we have to think about her era and what she was trying to survive within. She was accused of being obscene, lascivious, lewd, and dirty, and she was also called insane. My. You talk about the American Inquisition. Now, the history with women being abused when they started demanding that they have rights. There are awful stories, just awful stories. Women being, you know, hose put down their mouths and so that they, because they spoke out, this is terrible, and tortured, really, in a way. And this happened in the United States. Tell us about the American Inquisition.
Well, in particular, in the 1890s, there was this tension in society. There was this conservatism that was coming about. It was religiously inspired. And there arose organizations like the YMCA, which we tend to think of today as fairly secular. It's swimming pools and athletic activities and things. But at the time, the YMCA stands for Young Men's Christian Association. Mm-hmm. And it was founded specifically to attempt to combat what they saw as this growing corruption in society, this sexual excess that was taking place. And so the YMCA was specifically designed to get young men who were coming into the cities to work, get them off the streets and into wholesome activities so that they wouldn't be led into sexual temptation. And so they were the original organization that funded a man named Anthony Comstock. Anthony Comstock really led a great deal of this inquisition, which was designed, what he wanted to do was to stamp out obscenity in the society. Everything that he saw that was impure, that would lead people into sexual temptation, sexual corruption, lead people into having sex, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so he founded or was instrumental in the founding of an organization called the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And this was a private organization. It was bankrolled by industrial magnates like J.P. Morgan and Samuel Colgate. These were captains of industry. They had a lot of money, and they put a lot of money into him. And yet he was able to lobby Congress and get the Comstock Law passed, which made it illegal to send anything that was obscene through the mail. Now, obscene meant that it dealt in any way with sex. That was basically the only definition. And so this was, even keep in mind, private letters. If you were writing home to your wife, you were on a business trip or something, and you wrote home something sexual, technically that was a violation of the Comstock Law, which was federal law. So that was, you know, a federal rap. So Comstock had this law passed, and again, he's working for a private organization, but he managed to get himself deputized as a postal inspector, which meant that even though he wasn't a sworn officer of the government, he had the power to intercept mail, to read mail, and to go and bring federal officers to arrest people that he believed were in violation of his law. So this swept the country around the late 1800s, and was all kinds of people had been brought up into it, but he particularly focused on women. It was particularly outraged him when anyone wrote about sexuality, when anyone discussed sexuality publicly, but when it was women, it seemed even worse to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went after a lot of women. He went after Victoria Woodhull, who was active in the suffragist movement, trying to get the vote for women. She had exposed a scandal involving a pastor having an extramarital affair, so that was particularly what he went after. So he went after a lot of women, and Ida Craddock was one of the women that he went after to try to prosecute because she was writing openly about sexual matters, which to him was obscene.
Mm-hmm. That came about to bite him big time eventually because he was unethical in so many ways. When we talk about that time frame, when Ida was 2.5 years old, this woman was incredible. She was reading at 2.5. She was actually reading. She was able to write by the time she was 5. Her mother, Lizzie, when her husband died, she founded a patent medicine business. And now it's what we call medical marijuana. I just have to chuckle because we have these things that have been done in history past. And it's almost like we're on this cyclical wheel that seems to repeat the same story over and over again. I mean, look at the battles we're going through with medical marijuana at this time. But she really started challenging at 25 years of age, which in the 1800s, a woman was considered over the hill by the time she was 25. It's almost like, gee, you don't have any value if you're not married and don't have, you know, 14 kids, because big families were the deal then, and that is what established a woman in as having value at that time, as being pregnant and having children and surviving the birth of however many she could possibly have. So here she is at the age of 25, considered a spinster, and she was the first woman to apply in 1882 for admission to the University of Pennsylvania. Tell
right.
us what happened there, because that was really something.
Right. I guess that before that, it had never occurred to anyone to try or something. I'm not sure. But there was no official policy that said that there were no women allowed. It was just understood that that women didn't go to college, and it was an all-male institution. But she went ahead and submitted all her material, and she sat for the entrance examination. She passed the examination with flying colors. She was recommended for admission by several members of the faculty. And when this got to the board of the college, they were faced with a crisis. They thought, well, we can't admit a woman. So it was that point where they passed a policy very hastily that said that only men could be admitted. And so she was denied admission even though she qualified. Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt that she was very intelligent. She was very highly motivated. And even from this early age, as you say, was late in what they would consider to be the active life of a woman in terms of her career, but this was really just the beginning for her, and she was challenging the status quo. She thought, well, why can't I go to college? Why can't I apply? And she would have been its first female student if they had not blocked her, if they had not been so afraid of that prospect that they blocked her admission to the university.
Isn't it ironic? Today there are more women going to universities and colleges than men.
Right.
And look at how long it took to be able to make that shift. It's just incredible. We have no idea about the individuals that sacrificed and really dared to break the mold of thinking that surrounded the processes at this time. And you have here all of the writings by her, and she got involved in writing, and you have an article called The Dance of the Abdomen, which, again, you put it back in that time frame. How did she get the opportunity to even have this published? How did this come about?
Well, The Dance of the Abdomen, or Danse du Ventre, as it was known at that time, which was French for Dance of the Abdomen, this was what we know today as belly dancing. It's very common now today, but the introduction of this art to the United States came at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. And there were all these international exhibitions, these performers from different countries who were coming to showcase their country's achievements at the World's Fair. And one of these was this attraction called A Street in Cairo, and they had a theater there, and they were showing belly dancing. Now, belly dancing at that time, there's a picture of one of these belly dancers in the book.
I know, it's hysterical.
It's really lovely because she's got a full shirt on with sleeves all the way to her wrists, and she's got these long skirts that go all the way to her ankles and stockings underneath that. Very tame by what we would consider our standards today when you think of what belly dancers wear today. But that was the traditional dress, and that was a fairly modest dress, really. But still, the show scandalized America because of the very suggestive movements of the dancers. These dancers were moving their hips. They were undulating their bodies. It made people think of sexuality, even though when there was no overt sexual reference during the show. It was very tame. But it was still a sensation. People flocked to see it. It was probably one of the most notorious shows on the Midway.
It sold out on tickets every time.
It sold out. and it was because people were so scandalized, they just couldn't stay away.
Right.
Well, of course, this did attract the attention of Comstock and the moral reformers. He attempted to have it shut down. The fair actually didn't make money till the very end, nobody actually moved to shut it down because they really needed the income.
Right.
But he really tried to have it shut down, and when he couldn't do it through official channels, he went to the press, and he wrote about how scandalous it was. Of course, he never went to see it, but he had heard enough, so he said it was horrible. So he wrote, there were all these articles in the New York World, which was a popular newspaper, about how scandalous and how corrupting this dance was. And Ida Craddock wrote to the newspaper, and she was one of the few people that wrote in defense of this performance of the belly dance. And she said that, in fact, the belly dance was not a scandalous thing. In fact, it was very moral, and it was had moral teachings that it was trying to get across about female control of the body and in particular, female mastery over their own sexual forces. And so she wrote a letter to the newspaper explaining that this shouldn't be seen as license or something that was spurring people to sexual abandon, but rather as a teaching about sexual self-control, which, of course, ultimately was what she thought, I mean, was what the YMCA was trying to get towards, was sexual self-control. But, of course, this was a scandal, and that was what brought the attention of Anthony Comstock to Ida Craddock, because she was openly defying him in the press.
Mm-hmm.
She did get some supporters from that article, but she also got a lot of detractors. But that was important because that was kind of her outing. That was her first time that she came out with this position. It was not her first time in the press. She was, as we mentioned, she was very smart, and she had published reviews of plays and things in the Saturday Evening Post and popular periodicals like that. But this was her first sort of activist act in public, and that was what sort of got the whole thing started.
Well, what's also fascinating to me is that she was so open. She was a woman that had become very involved with the Theosophical Society, with spiritualism, with a number of different aspects of paranormal phenomena. And she herself had, as you relate here, and she's very open with this, that she had a spiritual union with someone. And she writes about this in a great deal of detail. And she said this is one of the things that enabled her to be more open with her sexual nature. And I know we're sort of running out of time here, but your story about how it affected her life, how she felt liberated, she felt encouraged. There is a sad ending to her life, if you would want to take it in that context, but she made a particular choice. And I would want my listeners, if they are intrigued with what we have shared already about a woman that was way ahead of her time on many, many levels. But I when I went through this and I thought of her and I thought how her papers had been saved by an attorney and how you were able to put this book together, when you were doing this research, when you were reading about this incredible woman, how did this affect you?
It was very inspiring. I had not known about her before, and when I found all this material, because at first I had heard about one work of hers, and that was what led me to dig for more. And then I saw that there was this tremendous amount of material. And only one of her books had been published before, and it was published after her death. But there was so much more there. There were so many other writings that had really just been ignored. And so when I was reading this, I was just amazed at all this that had come to light, how important it was in the history of human sexuality, in particularly in the development of the trends that later came to be, and also in spirituality and sexuality in the particular groups and practices and doctrines about spiritual sexuality that came about from her time. So when I saw all this, I knew that I was looking at something that was very important historically and very seminal in the growth of all these things that would later come to be known today.
Well, it was absolutely a joy to me, and maybe that's not very nice, to find out that Anthony Comstock, who thought he had total power over every woman and everything, and he abused his power so horribly, that after her death, he did not have that power anymore. And he tried to convict Margaret Sanger for promoting birth control through the mail, and it didn't work. Times had changed. Women were beginning to stand up for themselves, and men were supportive of that, too. So it's a part of history that I think if we do not, the saying, if you don't look at the past, if you don't understand what happened in the past, you're going to repeat it. The past will repeat itself unless you become educated to know why you don't want it repeated again. And I think that this is something for our young women, and I think also for people just to read, to discuss. I think it's an awesome, awesome book. Now, how can people find out more about Ida? What is your website? Because your book, Sexual Outlaw, Erotic Mystic, The Essential Idacratic, is an incredible publication. How do they find out? What's your website?
I have a website, sexualoutlaw.com, and you can go there to find out more about the book, to read some excerpts and order it, of course, and find out more about Ida Craddock and her extraordinary life and her works.
I agree. Sexualoutlaw.com is the website, and I will tell you, this is a book. If you think you're hearing about some extreme practices that are being done in other countries, realize that it took a lot of courage by people like Ida to make the change, to make people aware that this was not the right thing to do. And I just think it's a fabulous publication. And Vera Chappelle, I am so glad that you did this, and I so appreciate you being on the air with me today. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Sexual Outlaw, Erotic Mystic. Go to sexualoutlaw.com. It is a powerful publication. Donna Sebo here. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Rio. I'm the author of the cutting-edge book, Hooked on Raw. I want to give you and your loved ones the gift of optimum health. So when you order my book, Hooked on Raw, which has over 350 delicious, healthy recipes, I'll include my new DVD, What's Not Cooking in Rio's Kitchen, for a half price. Just go to my website, rawfoodinfo.com, and click on Holiday Special. That's rawfoodinfo.com. Click on Holiday Special.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, so if you'd like to give me a buzz at 888-815-9756, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. That's 888-815-9756. Now, I do want to let you know, tomorrow we're going to be talking with Linda Cardini, Bear Speaks. Bear Speaks. It's about a grizzly. And it is just going to be wonderful. And we're still working through some challenges with our computer. So on the BBS listing, you're not going to find the guests. And I will be posting that as soon as I possibly can. So next week, let me let you know about what's coming up. We've got Mark Sharon. It's titled Nice Bike. It is a wonderful story about how to deal and interact with people. And then, live from the other side, Maureen McGill is sharing stories about people that have had experiences with loved ones on the other side and the Great Penguin Rescue. This is a story that is mind-boggling. Can you imagine rescuing 40,000 penguins after a major oil spill. Well, it was a major one off of the coast of South Africa. This is a true story that is just incredible. And then we're going to be talking next Thursday with Elizabeth Cooper, dining with a dollar diva, her cookbook. This is a woman that has a passion for dollar stores like you would not believe. She is so much fun. So we're going to be chatting with her next week. And then Triumph and Hope. Barbara Jo is going to be my guest. People do incredible things at all ages. Barbara Jo she was 60 years old. She decided she was going to join the Peace Corps. Now, you'd think it's in her 60s, she's going to join the Peace Corps? You got to be kidding. This woman is amazing. She's been associated with the Peace Corps for a number of years. She's now in her 70s, and she still is working with the Peace Corps. So we've got a powerful lineup of people next week, and I invite you to join us. In the interim, give me a call if you'd like to chat at 888-815-9756. I was watching a program, and it was just every little bits here, because sometimes I don't have very much time just to sit down and watch information on television. And they were talking about a model that had died just recently. She was 28 years of age, and she was anorexic. And she went down to, I think, something like 60, 68 pounds. I mean, it was unbelievable. The photos of her were just hideous. She just wouldn't eat. And, of course, she starved to death, and she died. Now, this is a recent occurrence. Well, there was a story about another model that I came across, fashion models who had been purging in order to look svelte for a photo shoot. She began to eat after the shoot was completed. Now, keep in mind, she had been starving herself so that she would not look fat on the camera. She ended up eating a whopping 19 pounds of food. Now, think about that. How many people would sit down after being on a starvation diet, eating 19 pounds of food in all? And since the stomach can only hold maximum 4 quarts of liquid, her stomach ruptured, and it killed her instantly. We are amazing at sometimes what we do as human beings. And, of course, there's many sad stories about bulimia, the eating, the purging, and the dangers of ulcers, rupturing your esophagus, you know, just all kinds of horrific things. And interestingly enough, there was some critic that saw a ballerina from Europe, and he made fun of her. There was nothing wrong with her. She was absolutely gorgeous. This was just in the last few weeks. And he criticized her because she said she ate too many plum puddings. Boy, did he get pounced on. There was nothing wrong with her. And typically, ballerinas from Europe are a little bit heavier than American ballerinas. Well, I can tell you, I've heard so many stories through the years about people in the entertainment industry and also professional dancers. You do want to stay lean because when you're carrying extra weight, it presents a challenge for you. But being excessively skinny is not a good thing. And when I was a little girl growing up, I'll never forget my mother taking me to see a seamstress. The seamstress's name was Jane. And Jane worked for Mr. Blackwell. Now, Blackwell was known as one of the finest fashion designers in Hollywood many, many years ago. And his fashion shows and everything else were just absolutely incredible. And Jane was an awesome seamstress. And she saw a lot of fashion shows that Blackwell did, and so she would offer for clients to make similar outfits for them. And, of course, it wasn't going to cost you thousands of dollars, but she just did an incredible job, and she made some outfits for my mother. And, in fact, I still have some of those outfits. And I was astonished. I can remember listening, and I was so little, but I can remember her showing us things at the fashion show, but more than anything else, she'd talk about these models that would come in. And this is many years ago. And she'd say, you know, these girls just smoke cigarettes and they don't eat much of anything, live on cigarettes and coffee. And she said, when they're changing their clothes, I can count the bones in their back. She said, I can tell where their ribs are and wherever, you know, where the vertebrae are. She said, it is so sad because they're not healthy. Now, this is a number of years ago, and we still have a similar problem today. And that all has to do with image. So it's important for us as women, and it can affect men, but men do not have the aspect with anorexia and bulimia to the extent that women have. Because in American society, being pencil thin, a twiggy kind of a look, is what is considered, that's the way you're supposed to be. Well, women aren't designed that way. That's not the way the bodies are. However, there has been that fixation, and it is really a joy to me when I can see women enjoying the size that's natural for them and enjoy being who they are. And whoever you are, if you're battling a weight challenge and you find it's too easy to pack on the pounds, boy, can I raise my hand to that one. But you want to look good and you want to be healthy and you want to take care of yourself. And being excessively thin just is not a good idea. Because your body has to be able to take whatever nutrition you have and to be able to utilize it effectively so that everything works well internally. Really does make a difference. So take care of yourself and be good to yourself. You'll be very glad that you did. I was sent a cute little joke by one of our listeners, Betty. She said, I wanted to share this with you. This is about a new teacher. There was a gentleman who had served with the Marine Corps, and when he left the service, he decided he wanted to become a school teacher, and before school started, he happened to injure his back. Well, he was required to wear a plaster cast around the upper part of his body. Fortunately, the cast fit underneath his shirt and wasn't even noticeable. On the first day of class, he found that he had been assigned to one of the roughest classrooms in the school. When he found out that he was getting the dregs, so to speak, these were bullies, these were kids that no other teacher wanted to deal with. It didn't intimidate him at all. What he did, he walked confidently into his classroom. They were just causing all kinds of commotion. He opens one of the windows in the classroom, nice and wide, sits down at his desk, and a breeze came through the window, made his tie flap. He took a stapler off of his desk and stapled his tie to his chest. What a visual, right? He didn't have any problem with the students because all of the students saw what he did. And just looked at him. Class began. They paid attention. They didn't know about the cast underneath. That's a quick-thinking Marine. I just couldn't pass that one up. That is really cute. Donna Sebo here. We're going to be taking a break. If you'd like to chat with me today, give me a buzz at 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Rio, host of the Hooked on Raw radio show on rawenergyradio.com. If you're interested in the raw and living food lifestyle, along with the real story of what's happening to our health freedoms, and you don't mind a little controversy, listen to my radio show and podcasts on rawenergyradio.com. Each week, we interview guests and cover topics you won't hear on mainstream radio. Get informed, healthy, and involved. RawEnergyRadio.com.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author, Donna Sebo, will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. There were two dolphins that were at an aquarium in Fushan, China. Now, these two dolphins were dearly loved by the Chinese people, but somehow or another, plastic got into their tank, and both of these dolphins had eaten the plastic, and it was killing them. Now, they did not know what to do, but they realized there was a Mongolian herdsman named Bao Ishun, who is 7 feet 9 inches tall. He was able to help get the plastic out of the dolphin. Why? Because he had a 41 3/4 inch length with his arms, and he could pull the shards of plastic from the animal's stomach. Now, I've got a picture of him in front of me. This man is absolutely incredible. He was born in 1951 in Inner Mongolia in China. And Bao, he was perfectly normal until he was 16 years of age. All of a sudden, he had a massive growth spurt, and he reached his height of over 7 feet 7 years later. Now, usually when people have this kind of a growth pattern, they are going to have major health problems. However, he doesn't seem to suffer from any known growth disorder. He just is very, very tall, and there's no one else in his family like this. Now, what happened with the dolphins is that they were going through a great deal of depression, couldn't eat after they had nibbled plastic. Now, apparently plastic had been utilized in the edging of the pool. The veterinarians were not able to remove the debris from the dolphin's stomach with their surgical instruments because what was happening when they tried to do it, the dolphin's stomachs would contract in response to the tools they were using, so they just couldn't get things done. Now, people didn't have arms long enough to be able to reach the plastic. So the Royal Jiti Ocean World Aquarium sought the help of Bao. Now, they held the dolphin's jaws back by towels so he could reach in and they wouldn't bite him. And he was able to remove the largest pieces of plastic that were in their stomachs. And then the dolphins were able to digest the few remaining smaller pieces, and apparently they made a full recovery. Isn't that an incredible story? I mean, this is amazing. I'm sure no one ever anticipated that this gentleman would be called upon to be doing something so different. But I've got photos of it in front of me, how they kept the dolphins' mouths open. And, of course, they seemed to know, too, what he was trying to do, because they were miserable. It is something that is just an incredible story, so I did want to share that with you. Donna Sebo here, 888-815-9756, if you would like to chat with me today. Because of our subject about idocratic, I wanted to share a story with you about another woman, a Dr. Anita Figueredo. This woman, I received the material on her, and regrettably, I was not able to reach anyone in the family for an interview. But her story is just absolutely awesome. Now, she wasn't born in the 1800s, but she was a pioneer in her own way. She was a confidant of Mother Teresa, and she was a female surgical pioneer. Now, she had been abandoned by her father and left to be raised by her destitute mother, and who would ever have imagined she was going to become San Diego's first female surgeon? Being such a close friend to Mother Teresa, she also founded an organization that helps to feed, clothe, and provide medical care and other basic necessities to the desperately poor. She was born in Costa Rica in 1916. That nation at that time had no medical school. But by the age of five, she already knew she wanted to be a doctor. Now, her mother really recognized that she had a very special girl. And she packed up her daughter and moved to one of the poorest places in New York City, the Spanish section, Spanish Harlem it was called. And they lived in a tenement building. And her mother, Anita's mother, worked in a garment factory sweatshop so that she could support the two of them. Anita, being as sharp as she was, recognized that her mother was making tremendous sacrifices. And at 15, she finished school, Anita did, and the prestigious Baynard College offered her a full scholarship to become a pre-med student at 15 years of age. However, when she was being interviewed by the Bernard official, he insulted her high school, where she had been treated so well, and Anita stunned everyone, turning down the scholarship. She did not choose to go to a school that had the attitudes that this person demonstrated, but she was offered a scholarship at another school, Manhattanville College. Now, she was a top student. She graduated at 19 and then was accepted to Long Island Medical College. She was one of only four women among 90 men in the class. Now, of course, it was tough for women when they were admitted to medical school. The directors always were men, of course, and they viewed women as taking seats that rightfully belonged to men. And they also felt that most of those women just wanted to meet prospective prosperous husbands and would drop out or stop practicing once they got married. So she had a lot of stuff to work through, she and her fellow female students. Well, she did meet another student while she was at college. He became her husband. His name was Bill Doyle. They got married in 1942. He became a pediatrician, and they were married for 57 years. Until he passed away in 1999. Women were discriminated against. After she graduated from medical school, it was next to impossible to find a positioning worth the experience that she had attained. But World War II came along, and a lot of the male doctors were drafted overseas, so they needed women. Now, she was only 4'11", and she became one of the first two female surgical residents at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Her husband became quite successful as a medical officer. He was asked to become the chief medical officer in San Diego Scripps Memorial Hospital, and she naturally went with him, and she opened up her own successful surgical oncology cancer practice there for many years. And this was not an easy time for her as she was going through this, because she, during the year, she had two of her sons who were killed. A third child died from brain cancer. So she, even though she was a physician, wasn't able to help those that she loved. She met Mother Teresa, and that changed her life. She started Friends of the Poor, a charitable organization. This was in 1982. And she and Mother Teresa had a phenomenal association. She was often over in India to assist her. She lived until the age of 93. She had a cerebral hemorrhage, and everyone just loved her dearly. And there is so much about this woman that is just amazing, and I'm just thrilled to be able to talk about her. Know that for those of us today that are enjoying freedom, there are a lot of people that fought hard and walked the walk so that we could have them, and we need to respect and appreciate them, and continue upholding what they fought so diligently for. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a phenomenal day or evening. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about lessons from a grizzly. That's right, bear will speak. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be here tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.